Good morning, everyone. I know that I've seen pretty much all of you at church at this stage, but for those of you who don't know me, I'm Cleo. I am a pediatric occupational therapist, and I specialize in working with children and families, specifically who've experienced really challenging times, whether that is that they've experienced abuse, neglect, or trauma, or intergenerational trauma, whether there are ongoing challenges in the home, or whether there are things happening for the little ones or their families that just make life a lot harder to get through. When I spoke to God about doing this, I asked him what he wanted me to speak on. And sometimes this is tricky because although we would dearly love children, we have yet to be blessed with children. And so often I'm talking to mothers and fathers and caregivers who are already in the trenches and doing the things that they need to do. And it can be so easy to think, what do I know about this? And at the end of the day, every parent or caregiver I've ever spoken to will always be the expert on their child. I have knowledge about different theories, I have knowledge about different things, and I've worked with thousands of caregivers to find things that work in most spaces and places, but I will never know your child the way you know your child, and I will never understand your child the way you understand your child, and I will never understand you and your challenges the way that you understand you and your challenges. But what I do know is I know that parenting is one of the biggest challenges and greatest blessings that God gives us. It is something that takes everything we thought we knew about ourselves, everything we thought we knew about who we were, and everything we thought we knew about who we are, and flips it on its head. And what that means is that you go from knowing who you are and how you deal with things, whether they're joyful things or tricky things or sad things, and suddenly you are wholly and solely responsible for a little human who needs you to respond differently. And you may not know how to do that yet. So back to the Lord. When I asked him what to talk to you about, he reminded me that for parents, one of the biggest gifts and challenges is loving like he loves their little ones. Because many of us come from experiences and families that we either want to emulate, we want to be like, or we kind of want to run away from and do things differently. And that's basically the basis of today's session. Also, I am very much not about the talking at you. So if you have questions, comments, concerns, and want to engage, please just throw a hand up. I will absolutely take it at any time for any reason. So we've talked a little bit about little ones, and typically they're raised within the context of some type of family unit. We used to know what that looked like about 98% of the time. It used to be mum, dad, little ones, maybe some accessory people. That's no longer the case in many, many cases. Often little ones are cared for by family members that aren't mum and dad. They're cared for by friends and relatives. They're cared for by strangers in group homes. For the purposes of today, we're focusing on little ones that are cared for by their primary caregivers. And what that means is the people who spend most of their time with the little one, who that little one feels an attachment to. So the question is, what does a child need to be happy and healthy and whole? And you guys can answer this. I'm definitely going to make you answer. So what do you know that your children need to be happy and healthy and whole? They need to feel secure. Absolutely. Absolutely. What else do they need? They need to feel loved. Mm-hmm. What else do they need? Boundaries. Yes, please. Always boundaries. We will take a boundary. What else? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Maslow's hierarchy, food, shelter, water, sleep, all great things. So, fun and very interesting fact, it is easier to help a child feel secure in the absence of all of the physical things than it is to help a child feel secure in the absence of security and connection. So if we have a child who does not have access to clean drinking water, a roof over their head, sleep, and physical security, but they have access to one or two loving primary caregivers, that child developmentally will do significantly better than a child who has food, shelter, water, but does not have people that they feel safe with. And so that's where it comes to for you guys, okay? So you guys, as parents, are already providing the physical stuff. Great. As women, you are now trying to provide that security for your little people, but you're providing that not in isolation. It's not just you and your little people in a nice little bubble that's always safe and always protected and always well, and that you guys are feeling safe yourself. Often we're in situations where we're stressed or we're anxious or things are happening in our life that's making it hard for us to feel safe, but you still have to pass that on to your children. So that's kind of what we're going to talk about today. So our next slide is the circle of security. The circle of security is most often utilized in attachment circles. Attachment circles are people who spend a lot of time, energy, and effort researching how to help children feel connected to their parents. And the basis of almost all connection for children is those two hands, and those two hands are you. Those two hands are a secure base, so that's where a child goes out from to explore the world, and a safe haven, and that's where a child runs back to when they don't feel safe. And what they need from you is they need you to always be bigger, stronger, wiser, and kinder than they are or can be at this age. And that is a terrifying thought, because I don't know about you guys, but I don't always feel bigger, stronger, wiser, or kinder for myself, let alone for a little person who is completely reliant on me. So, wherever possible, we watch over our children, we delight in them, we help them, and we enjoy things with them. And then we protect them, we comfort them, we delight in them again, and we organize their feelings. So in other words, those are the things that our little people need to go out into the world, figure out what's out there, and then check in with you to make sure it's safe. And we want that cycle. We want our children, our teenagers, our young adults, our adult children, to be checking in with us about the world, because you're always going to be their parent. It doesn't matter what stage they're in, because you want to be the person who's saying, well, have you thought about the outcome of that if you go down that path? You know, you want to be the person who is helping them make great choices for their future, whatever age they're at. Have you guys ever seen your little people do this? And it's especially obvious in the toddler stage, right? Because they've just spent all of their time with you. But if you maybe go to a park, or you go to a water slide, or you go to a friend's house, and your little toddler will, like, run off and touch something and then look at you and then look back at you, and you're just like, oh yeah, that's okay, you can touch that. Or they go this way and they look at the edge of the pool, and they go, and you go, mm-mm, and they go, and you go, mm-mm, and they go, and you go, mm-mm, and they, oh. That's what we want, right? We want them to do that. We want them to test that. We want to put boundaries in place so they know when to do the right thing, but we want them to explore checking in with us so that we're helping them make those decisions. So, how do we be a safe base, a secure base and a safe haven in a challenging world? Because it's hard to raise kids. There is no one on earth who knows how to push your buttons the way your child knows how to push your buttons. All of them. Yeah, so this is not something that goes away with age. It is something that primarily develops before the age of 7. So if you have secure attachment developed before the age of 7, it is much better for the child long term. But the brain and its neuroplasticity continues to grow and develop even if you don't have it in place by 7. And sometimes we have adoptions, or we have shared care situations, or we have other things that mean that a child comes into a safe place after that age. The neuroplasticity means that you can still build that safety. It will take time. Not that it doesn't take time before seven, but it's a lot easier to set the pathways correctly first than to redo a pathway that's already been set. Does that make sense? Often, when we help our children become who they're meant to be, we forget who we are. And I see this time and time again. Mothers in particular are often doing the primary caregiving, and they will set aside all of their own needs for their child's needs. They'll be like, no, I will go and see the doctor when my child has been seen. I will take care of that thing that I desperately wanted to do for 30 years when my child has been taken care of. You know, I will put aside my need for sleep, my need for food, my need for exercise, my need for social connection, because I want to look after my child. And that is the absolute temptation when you are a mother, because you have a little person who you love so much, you will literally do anything to make sure that they have the life that they need to have, regardless of what's happening in your own life. And so the big challenge that we often see is not caregivers trying not to do the right thing. It's we see caregivers trying to do the right thing to the point where they're destroying themselves and they have nothing left to give. And so we go back to the old adage, put your own oxygen mask on first, right? If you've got something going on with your body that needs to be seen by a doctor, go and see the doctor. It won't kill your kids to be looked after by someone else for an hour while you get your physical health sorted. If you need a minute with a girlfriend to just be like, you know what, this is so hard and I don't know how I'm going to get through it, that is the most important thing you can do for your children. Because most of the time, we'll push those things aside until they become big problems. And when they become big problems, you are trying to keep a family together, because it's not just the kids. We all know that, right? Like, you're keeping mum and dad together and the husband together and the, like, you know, sorry. But most women are doing the role of caring for whole families, extended generations, checking in on everyone's parents, kids, nephews, nieces. So we need to look after us first as mothers, and that's really, really tricky because we're not wired that way. The other thing that's really challenging is that when we parent, we see basically two types of parenting. Parents who want to do everything the way their parents did because they had great childhoods. We love that. It's the rarer of the two options, to be honest. But that's nice to see. It sets up an expectation that is hard to meet for that parent. The more common thing that we see as parents trying to do the opposite of what they saw in their parents, because it wasn't the easiest childhood for them, and they want different for their children. And that tends to be a pendulum swing where they try so hard to go one way that they bounce back and end up finding themselves doing the way things happened with their parents. And that's really common. That's why it's called generational trauma. But most of us are looking at our friends, our families, our husbands, the internet, for any information we can get on how to do a better job of being a parent. And the problem is that the information out there is not great. And the information that we pick up, especially in places like the internet and parenting groups and mums and bubs groups and stuff, is often very, very skewed to particular demographics because that's what algorithms show us. And so we're trying to find information in a world that is broken, in a world that isn't living the way that we were designed to live. And that information comes back to us and informs our parenting, and things slip in that we never thought we would allow to slip in. But the most common thing that happens is all the information in the world, instead of making you feel better about the parenting that you're doing, it makes you feel worse. I'm not enough. I don't set enough boundaries. I set too many boundaries. I don't give them enough good food. I don't give them enough treat food. I don't know how to help them do this. I don't know how to help them do that. Everything says everyone else is parenting better than you. Just so you all know, that's a lie. That is a lie that you are told to be sold things. That is a lie that you are told so that other people feel better about their own parenting. And that is a lie that you are told by the devil to make you believe that you are not enough for the responsibility God has given you. So, where does our help come from? I found this great quote by Stormy Omara. I'm definitely butchering her name. I'm so sorry, Stormy. Omaratin? Omaratin? Anyway, We don't want to limit what God can do in our children by trying to parent them alone. Trust God to take care of them. So obviously this doesn't mean that we go, oh, God's got it. You do what you want. We've seen that. It doesn't work. It also doesn't mean that you just stand there and say, God will sort you out. But what it means is that just like every part of our life, the best thing that we can do is turn to God, is talk to God, and ask him what he would like us to do in this situation, in this instance, in this moment. Because at the end of the day, the wisdom and knowledge that the Lord provides in any of our parenting spaces is going to far exceed anything we find within ourselves, anything we find within our families, and anything we find within the internet. Because he doesn't parent the way that the internet tells us to parent. He is the Heavenly Father, and he is the model for how all parenting should be done. And he gives us children. They are a gift from him. I promise you that he's not giving you any gift that you are not equipped to support with his help. So, when you have questions, God first, this family second, because this is a nice group of solid women. Everything else comes after. And by the time you get to everything else, it doesn't matter. The big things are taken care of. I have some questions that I would like to move on to in a bit. But before we move on to questions, that was a lot of information, and I would love to hear if anyone's got any questions for me, if there's anything in particular that you would like to talk through a bit more, or if there's anything that's new or different to what you expected to hear, or if there are any questions online.
So when we parent together with God, trusting God to do the things that he needs to do in our children's lives, what advice would you give when you're parenting teenagers where they want to push boundaries and they want to have some independence, but at the same time they're still in your own home?
So I would change my advice slightly depending on the age of the teenagers. So if we're talking about sort of the tween years, 10 to 14-ish, that's one sort of thing. And then from 14 to 18, we get a little bit more tricky. It's an excellent question, and this is something that comes up all the time because those teenagers are right in the middle of that, I don't need you. I can do this. If I moved out tomorrow, I would be fine. They fully believe that, by the way. They're wrong, but they fully believe that. And so what happens with our tween years, with our 10 to 14, is they are going to push back and say, I don't need boundaries. I don't need you to tell me what to do. I know better. I know this. And they're going to try some things and they're going to fail. And they're going to try some things and they're going to succeed. And the thing is that with early teenage brains, they immediately forget the things they failed. And they only think about the things they succeeded at. And so they're coming home and they're going, yeah, well, I had a win today. Ignore the 10 losses. Like, no. I had a win. I know what I'm doing. I know how to look after myself. And this is where the balance between... So I often talk about bigger, stronger, wiser, kinder, right? And when we think about bigger and stronger, I'm talking specifically about boundaries. As the parent, your job being bigger and stronger is to find a way to set a boundary that is safe but not overbearing. Your job to be wiser and kinder is to find a way to do that in love, right? And so that's where God comes in. The Lord, in all of his wisdom, knows how to set a loving boundary. He knows how to say to us, the reason this is in place is because I love you and I need you to be safe and well. And those are the types of boundaries that are really important for our tweens. So it's not just about giving them a boundary. It's about giving them the why of the boundary and acknowledging what they think. And so if we're talking sort of 10 to 14, I would often help parents to frame things such as, I know you want to go out with your friends and stay out until midnight, but I also know that you have school at 7:30 tomorrow morning, and that if you stay out until midnight, you won't be able to get up and go for school. And that's a problem for all of us. So as your parent, I will let you go out with your friends until 9 p.m. or whatever time is appropriate for you. But when that time comes, I expect you to return home without any difficulties, or you will not go out with your friends next time. And so it's about giving them, this is what's happening, this is why it's happening, this is the consequence if you push back too hard on that boundary, and then sticking to it. If they don't come home at 9 without whinging, next time they ask to go out, you go, so do you remember last week when I let you go out until 9 p.m., and you came home at 9:15 and whinged at me for an hour before you went to sleep? Yeah, we're not doing that again. It's a no. We'll reconsider this next time if you can remember how to behave when you get home. And it's got to be that hard and fast because they truly believe that they can live by themselves. Honestly, 14-year-olds think that they could rule the world if we let them. Truly, truly. If we're talking about older children, if we're talking about like 15 to 18, they're in your house, you're still responsible for them, you still want to be able to be like, absolutely not under my roof. We're at a stage where their boundary pushing can get really dangerous really quickly. And so we want to try and find a healthy balance. And this is where all of the work that you've done in their younger years stacks up. Like you spent 15 years at this point saying, it's okay, calm down, talk to them properly, remember that I'm the adult and they're the child. Yep, I see what's happening here. This is my calm, measured response. You've spent 15 years holding yourself together so that you can have a rational conversation with a toddler and a tween and a baby. This is where that comes into play. So when they get to 15 to 18, they're not going to ask so much anymore. I mean, you might have really great kids, they might ask, but most of you are going to get, Mom, I'm going out with my friends, I'll be home at 11. And you're going, I don't think so, it's a Tuesday. And they're going, but Justine invited me. And you're going, still a Tuesday. And they're going, Amy's going. And you're going, it's still a Tuesday. And so that's where we have a totally different conversation. And that conversation looks more like questions. Why do you want to go? Why do you want to go to this party on this night with these friends? Because the questions are going to tell you, the answers to the questions are going to tell you whether that's a great thing for them to, for you to relax the boundaries and let them do it, or whether this is a boundary you need to hold. And so when your older teens answer questions, they're going to say things like, well, Amy's going and her brother Johnny's coming and he's really cute and he's 17. We're holding that boundary. Thanks, but no thanks. Or they're going to say, it's been really hard at school and I miss my friends because we're in different classes and we're not seeing each other as much and I really just want to spend some time with them. And at that stage, we're going to say, okay, that sounds like a much more reasonable reason to want to spend time with your friends. What if it wasn't a party? What if we set up a games night on Thursday this week for some of your friends to come and play, I don't know, what do kids play these days? Catan, Monopoly, pick a game. Jenga. Jenga is a great one. I love using Jenga to talk to teens because it doesn't require that much brain power, but they can focus on something else while you talk to them. They'll tell you so much, so much. I have had 15-year-old boys talk to me about their toileting habits while playing Jenga. They didn't know my name when they walked in. Jenga is great. So that's kind of the difference where 10 to 14, you're really trying to maintain that bigger and stronger with the wiser and kinder. 15 to 18, there is going to come a time in the very near future where they have to make decisions on their own. And those questions that you're asking them, if you do that well and hear the answers well, those are the questions they will ask themselves when they step out into the big wide world and they're suddenly making decisions on their own. They're going to be like, oh, why do I want to go to this thing? Who's going to be there? What's going to happen if I go? What am I missing if I go? What am I not missing if I don't go, you know? So those are the questions we want them to start thinking about as they get older and move into their early adult years so that they can continue to make good decisions when they're not with you in your home. Did that answer the question?
Okay, I have a question. You meet with different families and parents. So what is overall through the time that you've been doing this, what is the number one difficulty to mothers that you kind of encounter a lot?
I would say the number one difficulty that I encounter from mothers is that thought pattern that they're not enough. And that thought pattern is incredibly detrimental, because the thing is, ladies, if you are having that thought pattern, I can tell you now you are a mother who is enough. Because the mothers who, for whatever reason, are not able to support their children in the way that that's needed, they are also not able to have those thought patterns. Often the mothers who are struggling with abusive relationships, addiction, their own trauma history that is just too big to overcome, complete lack of resources, depression, particularly postpartum depression, all of the women experiencing those things very rarely have the capacity or ability to think to themselves, how can I be a better mother? So if you are having the thought, I'm not enough, how can I be a better mother? I want to do the best for my children. You are already in the category of mothers who are doing enough. And the other secret that I've got for you all is that while we say always bigger, stronger, wiser, and kinder, what we mean is approximately 20% of the time. 20% of the time is literally all it takes. If you have solid parenting 20% of the time, that is enough for your child. God wasn't silly. He knows the world that we were born into. He knows what's happening. He knows that if we have to be everything to our little people 100% of the time, no one's coming out of that well. So 20% is literally enough. And that means that if you spend 15 minutes at some stage before your kids go to school being enough as a parent, 15 minutes at some stage after they come home being enough as a parent, and you have a game on Saturday, play catch in the backyard, play Jenga with your teenagers, cuddle your baby, we're doing enough. That's enough. And it is a lie that you need to be more. You do not need to be more. More is taking the time to talk to God. More is taking the time to be present with Him, because He will show you where you can do things differently. And it's not condemnation. It's correction. And the Lord is the best parent that we have. And so when He corrects you, pay attention, because that's how you're going to correct your little people. Because He is doing it well. And that's what we want to model.
I have two questions.
Yep.
The first one is, I had encountered a teenager who came and asked, is it okay for parents to argue in front of the children? That was one of the thing that the teenager asked me, and I'm wondering, like, for parents, how far can we be transparent to our children? Because I have the other spectrum where kids say, my parents never argued, my parents have never, you know, they don't have any kind of issue, which is not true either. Because the parents are hiding so much from the parents and from the children. So that's one question. And the other question is, in today's world, there are a lot of young people, teenagers, that are facing all kinds of trauma and depression. How do we identify? And if our kids are one of them, then how do we best help them come alongside instead of ignoring the issue or, you know, pushing it aside?
For sure. So for your first question, you kind of touched on the answer in the question, and it is that having arguments the way that most of us think about arguments, big screaming matches, yelling, that sort of stuff, not okay in front of your kids. But having honest and open discussions with each other about things that are tricky within reason. We're not going to be talking about, you know, certain things that children don't need to be exposed to. But having honest and open discussions with each other about things that are tricky, modeling healthy discussions. Because if you have a relationship where there is no arguments, I'm telling you now, your relationship is in trouble. If you don't trust each other enough to have a discussion about the hard things, then I would see someone now. Because if you don't trust each other enough to have the hard conversations, then there's so much going on for both of you separately that's not coming together. But if you can model for your children how to have a good, solid discussion as an adult in a romantic relationship with someone, that is going to teach them so much about how they should expect to be treated at all times, not just when things are going well, but when there are things you disagree on. And it's going to teach them so much about how they should treat others when there are things that they don't agree on. And so what I mean by healthy arguments is I mean things like, there's a difference between, you did that thing again that I've told you not to do, and, hey, can we have a discussion about this particular thing because I'm finding that it's still happening and I'm just wondering why? How can we make it so that that is not something that is still happening in our household? Because I don't like it. It makes me feel X, Y, Z. And so there's a huge difference in the language that we use, in the accusatory tone, in the understanding that we have for the other person. Because what you say when you say, can we have a discussion about, is you are saying, I know how I feel about this. I want to hear how you know, how you feel, what's happening for you in this situation, instead of, you keep doing this. Now, having said that, we're all human. There is going to be a moment you turn around and you're like, why would you do that? We've talked about it. The other thing that's really important for us to model for our children is what we call repair. And that is when you do make a mistake, as an adult who has emotions, because we all do, and you go, do you know what? It's been a hard day. I shouldn't have spoken to you that way. When I'm feeling a little bit calmer, can we please have a discussion about this? Because I find it really tricky, you know. And so that's also good. They need to see that parents fail, but they need to see that parents have the skills and abilities to fix it when they fail. The second question is a lot more tricky. And so often when you read stuff online and things like that about addiction, about depression, about trauma, about things that have happened outside of your home and space that you don't know about but have affected your children, there's a list of like signs to look out for. And the problem is that those signs don't take into account individuality in children. And so they say things like, is your teenager spending all of their time in their room? Do they hide from you? Are they mumbling one-word responses when you ask questions about their day? They may have been sexually abused on the playground. No, they might just be a teenager. Like, that's kind of standard. So what I much prefer is to tell parents to look out for dramatic, sudden changes. Okay? So if you have a kid that is 110% like, hey, I just got home from school and let me tell you about my day and this is what's happening and did you know that Jenny's dad is going to India next week and Jamie is dating Ken and he's not a great choice and this is happening, blah, 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 blah. And they come home one day and they say hi. And they walk away. Maybe they're having a bad day, but maybe there's something that we need to ask a question about in that. And so you might go, hey, I noticed when you came home you seemed a little bit down. Is there anything that happened that you want to talk about? And they might say no. And at that point you go, okay, I'm just letting you know I'm here if you want to talk about it. And then the next day you see what happens. And maybe the next day they come in and they're like, woo! And you're like, okay, so can we just have a chat about yesterday? Because it feels like something was different. Do you want to talk about it now that you're feeling a little bit better? And they might say, I really like Johnny, but it turns out Johnny likes Anne, and it just made me sad yesterday. Great. We love this, okay? But they might say, someone at school has been telling me that I'm really stupid, and it just got to me yesterday. And that's where we start to go, okay, what other questions do we need to ask about this? Is this a pattern of behavior? Is this something that is going to have a longer-term effect on you? Is this something that you have internalized that we should deal with before it becomes a big problem? So it's kind of dependent on the answer. The other thing is they might come home the next day and they might go, hey. And you might go and ask, do you want to talk about it? And they might still say no. Okay? And there is a really fine line between protecting and respecting their privacy and finding out what's happening, you know? And this is going to come down to your individual knowledge of your children. So you might have a little one that you know takes about a week to process things, takes a little bit of time, will come to you 7 days later, you've learnt this because they've spent 15 years being like, no. And then they'll be like, Mom, can we talk about last Friday? Like, so if you know that your child takes about a week, gently ask them for about a week, and then at the week, you say, hey, I think we need to have a discussion about what's happening because your behavior has changed and I'm concerned. And that's when they have that time. But if you have a little one that you know takes about 2 days to open up, and they're not opening up on day four, that's when I would be offering alternatives. So I would say, it seems like there's something happening that you don't want to talk to me about. And pick a person that you know that they trust. And it might be their aunt. I'm the aunt. I'm the cool aunt, just so you all know. It might be someone else from the church group that you spend a lot of time together as a family. Temsula, you might say, if you don't want to talk to me, would you rather talk to Vicky about it? Because sometimes it's real hard to say things to your parents that you will happily say to another trusted adult, you know. And they might say, Miss Vicky, I love my mum, but she's driving me nuts. And I don't want to say that to her, you know, but I had a bad week and that's all it is. Or they might say, Mum, something happened at school and someone said something about my family that I don't know how to address with them and I don't know how to talk about with Mum, you know. Or they might say, Miss Vicky, someone hurt me. Someone touched me inappropriately. Someone said something awful to me. Someone did something awful to me and I'm ashamed and I don't want my mum to know. And at that stage, Miss Vicky says, wow, that is really rough. But I think it's really important that we get your mum involved so that she can help us through this, you know. Because these are the things that kids hide. These are the things that kids feel shame over. These are the things that stop kids from being able to talk to their parents. But if we have another trusted adult, that's a backup point. We can be like, you don't want to talk to Miss Vicky? What about someone else? You know, do you want to talk to a man? Do you want to talk to someone close to your age? Do you want to talk to someone? Kids will have a preference because it's going to depend on what the issue is. And so finding a way to get them back on track is so tricky sometimes. But that's when you just need to kind of go, okay. And also check in with God. Lord, is there someone that you know that they would open up to about this? Final resort, Jenga. Legitimately Jenga. Honestly, any game that requires a fairly minimal amount of cognitive power but a specific visual focus is going to help a teenager open up to you in so many ways. I promise, every time. Just be like, so how is school? Oh, no, the tower fell. Let's rebuild it. And they're going to be like... and they're going to be like, stack, stack, stack. This thing happened and I didn't like it. And you're going to be like... don't do that. Do this. Oh, yeah. That thing happened. Do you want to tell me about it? Because we're going to focus on the Jenga. We are not going to turn and look at our teenager for any reason during this conversation. Just focus on the Jenga. They're going to stare at the Jenga like their life depends on it, and they're going to share things with you that they would never tell you face to face. They're so simple in some ways. They want to talk. They just don't know how to do it. Questions? I had questions for three groups. What I would like for us to do is in our group tables, a few can do group one questions, group two questions, and group three questions, because I find that the biggest way that we share information as parents is by asking each other questions that we may not have thought of before and hearing the answers that other mothers give. Because at the end of the day, they're going to think about things so differently to how you think about things, and that's how we can learn from each other in a really healthy way. So if I give you sort of 10 minutes to have a discussion, and then we'll maybe talk about the answers that you guys come up with, or the things that stood out. Not everything that you say will be like, yes, but someone will say something on your table and you'll be like, that is what I needed to hear today.